Good afternoon, everybody. Wow, this is loud. Welcome to the last lecture in my part on concurrency. Next week, there will be Michael Petter talking on object orientation, mostly in different languages with traits and mixins and what have you not. So last week, we talked about software transactional memory as a opposing mechanism to locks. So locks can deadlock. Software transactional memory or transactional memory can live lock. So they both have their problems. But for high performance computing or anything that nowadays runs parallel software, transactional memory seems to be an appealing option because potentially several algorithms can access commonly shared resources at the same time. And if they do so in a non-conflicting way, then obviously they will run in parallel and thus be faster than a locked-based version. So I discussed this TL1 implementation of software transactional memory last time. So this TL2 implementation had this it's down here, has this idea of the global version counter, which is incremented each time a transaction commits and writes something. So a transaction that only reads will never have to increment the version counter because it will not change the state. So there is no update. And so the version counter, the global counter, basically sequentializes the committed transactions. So thereby the transactions are by definition serialized or serializable. Each time the version counter goes up, it means that a transaction tries or succeeds in committing, so it updates this, the memory locations, and the version counter is incremented. So, okay, so it uses a redo lock, so that means it doesn't store anything in main memory during the transaction, but tracks all reads and all writes in a data structure. And once the transaction tries to commit, it will lock all the objects, which means at actually acquiring a lock for that object. And it will then try to do the updates, or it will manage to do the updates because once it has acquired all the locks, no other transaction can lock them, the objects. Which means you only lock the objects that you actually write to, because that is, depends on the elements in the write set. In contrast to normal locking, where you just are more careful, you just say, oh, I could read or I could write this, so I need to lock this whole these objects, and maybe you never actually do write to these objects because they don't need to be written to. Okay, so I've briefly shown you this the implementation of the read. So in the read, if you read a value, you call this special read transactional function with this descriptor, the object that you want to access, and the offset that you want to access the offset at. Then you check whether that address you're trying to read is already in your redo lock. That means you have written it earlier. Then you need to return the value from the redo lock. And otherwise, you have to simply read it and put it into your read set. And you have to make sure that what you're reading is not something that somebody else has already updated, because then you're working on outdated data. Outdated data, yes. So the only reason why I'm showing you this, because last time I said the way you do this is you read this timestamp and the property whether the object is locked. Then you read the value from the offset, and then afterwards you read the timestamp again. And then you don't have a conflict. That means your read succeeds because nobody else has written yet if the object is not locked, because if it were locked, then there is another transaction that's currently holding the object, has locked the object, and is writing to it. So what we're reading is nonsense. It could be part old version, part new version. And then here it says that the version that we read before we actually read the values from the objects has to be strictly larger than the read version of the transaction. may not be larger. If it is larger, that means some other transaction has committed, has incremented the global count, the global clock, and our transaction reads this global clock as the read version, which is this here, and so somebody has committed. This means somebody has committed since we started running. And then we abort the transaction. Now, this condition I told you last time, I would check why you have to compare the timestamps, and I looked it up in the original paper and in the book where I got this from, and they don't really say. So I think this is actually not necessary, because if you check that it's locked, and if the version number is not greater, it cannot be smaller, so it must be equal. So I think this is superfluous. I'm not going to ask you any questions in the exam about this, at least, because I don't find a good reason why that test is there. So I just wanted to inform you. Writing is easier. The commit I said, yeah.
What if it gets locked just after we check whether
it's locked? Maybe. So you mean if it's locked here or here, and the version stamp is only increased here?
Yeah, or if it's locked just after we checked inside the if, before the first or.
Well, we've read the data, so it all depends on what we're doing here. So these are register variables. So we can just like talk about what happens in between these statements here.
Okay.
So maybe the other thread could lock this, could acquire the lock here, so we haven't observed this, could write the version stamp here, and maybe that way, but I'm not sure. Well, and then in that case, we should not compare the versions. We should compare this whole blob of memory. So in the original paper, it's all text. It's all English. There's no algorithm written there. So it's all English. You have to guess what they really mean. So what they have is that the lock, the semaphore, the single bit that you need to lock an object, and the version counter is just in one word. So they compare that. They check that the single one word has not changed. And the book separates the version from the lock. So maybe they got it wrong by separating it, and they just want to check that it's equal. Because if you separate it and you have the semaphore taken here and the version increased here, then it's still not broken.
But what if they take the lock so after the atomic, but right before the result, and they take the lock, they write the data, they unlock it, and then you read the result, it's different from the one you
check. Yeah, so V2 is different from V1, and the locks. Oh, what do you mean exactly? That,
yeah, so
again.
If another thread locks right before result, is the object offset. So before result.
Here.
Yes, and they change it, and then you read the new value, but you think it's the old value. And then, but if you then take timestamp again, you can see that that has happened, and then you know that it's wrong anyway, and then you can.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so the idea is that the new value is written here, and then that must mean that the lock is acquired here, otherwise I would see that.
No, but the new value is also written before you read it. So before.
Okay, lock here and update here, meaning I think I'm reading this version and it's not locked, and then I'm reading the new version,
and then I
hopefully read the new version as well, otherwise it's still broken. Yeah, okay. So that might make sense. But I really have to ensure that I update the version of the object before I unlock it. Then I cannot observe that this object is... I need to check that this object here is not locked as well. So I think this is translation from the book, which got it from the paper. So the paper says lock and counter is the same 32-bit, 64-bit value. And then it makes sense to say, well, the lock and the counter may not have changed, because this, like according what you said, if you lock and update here, then here the version is, if I then write the version down here, I'm still reading the old version. No, I'm reading the new value, but I'm looking at the, it looks like I still have the old version. So V2 is equal to V1 still.
Why is it still the old?
Well, okay, so I mean update, I mean the value, the data value, and then the question is where's the version updated?
Yeah, also there, because you can't release the lock before, right?
Okay, so version update plus unlock. If everything, if all this happens after this atomic statement, then I'm reading a new version. If the version update and the unlock happens down here, I'm reading the previous version, and that's, then that would be bad, because I've read already the new value, because that has been updated. Yeah, so this is obviously a bit tricky. It works in the implementation. Maybe somebody should check the implementation. So if it's a single word, then maybe it works. Okay. So just to say that this is not, the slide is not necessarily correct. Okay, properties, well, it's opaque and all that because it doesn't modify the memory. So I kind of finished this last time. And so general challenges when using transactional memory. So the idea of transactional memory is that you execute atomic blocks by repeatedly trying to execute them non-atomically. And if you have a conflict, you're abort. So this has all sorts of problems, as we've seen with the question of whether we have isolation between other accesses that are outside a transaction. About opacity, whether a zombie transaction can see an inconsistent state. But it also has other things, like with caching, you could have the granularity of an object being in a transaction is too large. So if it's a very large Java object that contains all your global configuration and you use a system like TL2, where every object that you can possibly have in a transaction is a whole Java object and not just not 4 bytes of memory, then you could lock this big object and other accesses would try to access the object. And although the accesses are different offsets, you wouldn't notice. You would like still put them, regard them as a conflict. So the granularity of what you can put into your read set and write set might be too large. That holds for everything. Okay, so in this TL2 implementation, you also have false conflicts. So, for instance, if this thread and this thread executes in parallel and the execution is the time goes like this, so you first read the global clock version, say that is 12, and that is your reference. If you read anything that has a higher clock value in it, so if you read an object and the read version of that object is higher, then you have to assume that some transaction committed and updated that that object. But here, this is actually the case because some other object did write to X. So here the other thread updates, writes to X and increments the global clock to 13 and also writes, puts the clock version of the object X to 13. Then if we read from X, then we check that the transaction read version, which is up here, which is 12, whether that's unequal to the clock, the read version of X. And that's obviously that has changed. So the transaction will abort, although there's no real conflict. So this shows that the TL2 system is also generating false conflicts, even by the way it's implemented. So and also the TLS2 system, they use locks to basically commit the transactions, and that could, again, cause deadlocks, cause contention. So then you could re-implement TL2, like to make the granularity of objects smaller, or try to update all the objects in one go by somehow grouping the objects together. But that obviously is much more complicated and not doable in a generic transaction memory library. Okay, this is like the old idea that you use a atomic compare and swap to do that, but that's usually not so easy to do. So, but this atomic compare swap, that was the original very first proposal from the 80s, how to do transactional memory, where you just hold all your data in some sort, like in one object, then you create a new object and you atomically change the reference to the current object. Okay. So with locks, we had deadlocks, and with transaction, we have live locks. So transaction B might abort A, and when B starts again, transaction A might abort B again, and so on. So we might never have any progress, which is a big problem. Okay. And then, as with accesses outside of transactions, so non-TM accesses, we discussed a lot about that last time. There's other resources that are inherently non-transactional or not so easily transactional. So like any kind of storage management, so hard disks, condition variables, so if you want to simply suspend, you have to re-implement that. Your condition variables don't work as before. You might have volatile variables that usually should historically represent some hardware where you can just write to it and then later pretend you haven't done so. So that generally holds for I/O. So if there is an effect, you could try to get this single log automaticity or the transaction sequential consistency semantics. But in general, if you have I/O, say, you can, with any of these non-TM resources, you have several options. So one is to prohibit it. So sometimes this doing an I/O inside a transaction might simply not make sense, and then the compiler hopefully can reject that by identifying any function that does I/O. That depends on the language, and once the language is there and it's fixed, the compiler can never tell by the types that there is some I/O going on. You could also just execute it. And if you then observe that there is, just before some sort of I/O is happening, before a file is written, you could abort the transaction. And this is actually interesting if you have something like, what's it called, a stream buffer or something, whatever it's called, in Java, where you write something to a file and usually it just goes to a buffer, and only when the buffer is full it's flushed. So you could just write to the buffer, and if it's to the buffer, then the transaction goes through. If the file needs to be flushed, or this buffer needs to be flushed to the file, then the transaction aborts. And since it works in many cases, maybe you can transparently incorporate your file I/O in transactions. The other alternative is you say you make a transaction irrevocable. That means as soon as you do some I/O, you mark this transaction as in a way that it has to go through, which means that you have to make sure that any other transaction that touches any resource that this transaction needs is aborted. And if this transaction needs something that another transaction already has, then the other transaction is aborted, so that this transaction is guaranteed to succeed. Okay, and then you can also try to integrate the whole thing, make a new language or make new libraries for a language. And for instance, if you have file I/O, you could just if you write data to a file, you could just make sure that you always write to a buffer and that you never actually do a file I/O while you're doing that in a transaction. Or you could even try to do the transactional semantics somehow on the file system by remembering the pointer where you wrote the file and reading the buffer of the file beforehand or the part that you're going to overwrite. So in a nutshell, this is all not so easy. So transactional memory implemented in software is best used, or in general, best used just for transactions within memory. And if TM, your TM system reports irrevocable transactions, then that's the easiest way to integrate I/O. Okay. So that finishes software transactional memory, and today I want to talk a little bit about hardware transactional memory. So there is obviously the realization that the concurrency and all these the locks and all the atomic instructions, they can only go so far, and so the hardware manufacturers have gone to accept what's happening in the software community, namely that they implement transactions in software. So they nowadays there's also hardware transaction memory. So the idea is that in hardware everything is of fixed size, because if you have like redo buffers and undo buffers or whatever, then these structures have finite size and they have to be implemented in hardware. So the transaction will be in limited size when they're implemented in hardware. And usually, if conflict detection is lazy, that means if you kind of like do the transaction and then at the end you check whether you have a conflict, implementing all that in hardware is very complex. It's a complex thing to do, and also because on hardware you can do many things very fast on n parallel. So for instance, you can check whether an address is in your cache is very fast because you can ask all the cache lines in parallel which cache line contains the data or the address. And so there's some potential here to do all this eager conflict checking so that the detection, the occurrence, the detection, and the resolution is all happening at once. You can implement that in hardware because you can do that massively parallel. So this additional hardware that you have to use anyway makes it very cheap to perform the conflict detection, so you do it eagerly. For instance, if you use cache lines as to define your granularity of a transaction, then every cache line is either part of the transaction or it's not, and once it's part of a transaction, then if somebody tries to invalidate it because they want to write to it, you simply abort the transaction. So this was if you have a cache line that is in the read set of your transaction. If you have a cache line that is in your write set, that means you have already written to the cache line, but it's not visible to other people. So if somebody else says, I need to have that cache line, if they send you a read request or even a read invalidate to write it, then you need to write this cache line out. But since your transaction hasn't finished yet, you don't know whether there will be other writes. So you don't know whether your transaction will finish as it is. So it might write more elements, and you don't know so whether you can do that. So you also abort the transaction. That's kind of the basic principle. You use the cache lines and the messages of the MESI protocol to implement your transactions. So in summary, it is limited by hardware resources what you can do. And as a result, you always need a software backup. So if the hardware transaction fails, you might never be able to, even if you restart it, you might never be able to get the transaction to run through, because maybe you need 17 words that you're writing and the hardware can only track 16 words in its read or write set. Okay. So there's two principal implementations of hardware transactional memory. So either you invent a new set of instructions that are transactional accesses, so that is like you translate your program in a special way so that every read is a read TX and every write is a write TX. So you need new instructions to implement transactions. So you mark, so you create new instructions that are explicitly marked as transactional. So that's similar to the software implementation. So since this requires extra instructions, then that means what you can do, the memory accesses you can do, might be like much smaller than or much less generic than what the instruction set offers normally, which makes writing a compiler much, well, more difficult, because a transaction has to be translated differently. And then the question again is, what happens if you mix transactional and non-transactional accesses, because obviously the other instructions are still there and you could still run them. Does that mean that the transaction is aborted, or what does that mean? Okay. The other option is to make an implicit transactional hardware HTM, which means that you mark the beginning of a transaction, then you use all the normal instructions that you normally would use, and then you explicitly have one instruction that marks the end of a transaction. And then there's obviously some operations that don't make sense or that cannot be executed because they do some sort of I/O, or that, who knows, use some sort of like halt, something that puts the processor to sleep if it can't process the transaction actions, like the semantics of the transaction anymore, then that's not so good, like, or directly an I/O instruction. Okay, so for this implicit transaction, HTM use the same instructions, and the hardware interprets them transactionally because there's some flag internal inside the processor is set. Okay, so only instructions that affect the memory can be, and that can be cached, can be executed transactionally. So if you have some special operations that, say, flush a cache line or something, then these operations will automatically abort your transaction. So in addition, any hardware access, a call to an OS, if somehow a page table changes, like say you have a page fault, then that will all abort a transaction. But by the virtue of eager conflict detection, you have strong isolation. So it is really it is easy for the hardware, or relatively easy for the hardware, to really seal the transaction to be within the processor so that other processors cannot possibly observe what you're doing. So you have strong isolation, also meaning that you cannot just, there's no way to mix non-transactional and transactional accesses. Every non-transactional access from a different processor will just look as kind of like a mini atomic transaction. Okay, so examples. There's not so many. There's like something on experimental on, I think, Spark. But what is mainstream is that is an extension by AMD. It's called Advanced Synchronization Facilities. They define a logical speculative region. And there they have kind of new instructions. So they reuse old instruction and allow a lock prefix, which is just one byte that makes the instruction one byte longer. And then they use a normal opcode for, say, move. And then these special instructions allow an explicit data transfer between the normal memory and the speculative region. And then within this region, you can do something. But basically, it's just intended to create more larger atomic instructions. So besides compare and swap and fetch and add and stuff like that, you can create instructions that are a little bit bigger because the speculative region is really small. Yeah.
Isn't there also something like that from Intel on the newer processors?
Yeah, that's here.
Okay.
That's more interesting. So starting with Intel, the so-called Haswell microarchitecture, which they've introduced in September 2013, you have software transactional memory, but because strong isolation is not so easy to implement, they've stopped. They now ship a BIOS and microcode update that disables hardware transactional memory because they had a bug in there. So basically, there is no Haskell hardware transactional memory at the moment. There will be in the next releases, but we still have a machine where we hope we don't have this bug fix uploaded yet, so we can still use it there, hopefully. I think we can, right? We'll figure that out till next week. Okay, so we hope we can get you to write some programs with HTM on our Haswell machine. Okay, so the Haskell, the Intel transactional memory is one of these implicit transactional, in contrast to the AMD, which is rather this explicit transactional where you say what is transactional and what not, which means you can use the very normal instructions you'd normally use within a transaction. So the way it works is that it tracks the read and write set using cache lines. So one can imagine that it uses a single bit on each cache line that says whether the cache line is participating in a transaction. And if a transaction fails, then the CPU will have to backtrack and kind of like start where the transaction, like start at a location where the CPU state and all the memory is as if the transaction has never started. So the CPU now has a backup space for the whole CPU state that can be legally modified by a transaction. So all the registers and flag registers, they all have a copy that are reinstated once the transaction aborts. Nested transactions are also supported. So as we've seen, nesting two atomic blocks is the same as having just one atomic block. So what they do, they simply have a counter, and they count how many times they've seen start a transaction, and then each time they see end transaction, they decrement the counter, and only if the counter reaches zero, they know this is now the end of the atomic block, of the outer atomic block. And because it's in hardware, the transaction may abort at any time. So you don't, Intel doesn't say how big, how many cache lines, for instance, a transaction can have. They just say, it will work on some and it will not work on others. But they will give you some definitive criteria when a transaction will abort. Like if you go into the operating system, if there's a page fault, if you ever write to non-cached memory because it's implemented in the cache, then the transaction will abort. So if an inner transaction aborts, it means all of them are aborted. So nested atomic blocks is the same as one atomic block. Nested transactions are the same as just one transaction semantically. Okay, so there's two interfaces to the programmer. And they are kind of very similar if you just look at them in detail. So I'm first going to talk about the more general version, which is the restricted transactional memory, RTM, and the other one is called hardware lock elision, HLE. So the RTM, the restricted transactional memory. So this is all Intel terminology. So Intel adds four new instructions. They're called X begin, X end, X abort, and X test. So obviously X begin, as the name suggests, starts a transaction. And it takes an address in the code segment where you jump to in case the transaction aborts. So it's like a jump that's not executed yet. The XEND tries to commit the transaction that has been started by XBegin. And obviously you can nest them. So if the outermost XBegin is ended by an XEND, then the transaction commits. The X abort is what we've earlier called retry. So it is the transaction saying, I want to abort this transaction actively. And then there's an instruction X test that checks whether the process is currently executing inside a transaction. I don't know what that's useful for. Okay. The X begin is kind of an instruction. It's like if you've ever seen set jump in C, it's very similar to that. Set jump is very weird. It's kind of an exception handling mechanism. You say set jump in an if statement, and it will return false. And if you ever then or true, I think it will return false. And then in the else branch, you can call something, and if you then call long jump, you will jump back to where you call set jump, and then the set jump will magically return again with something which is non-zero, and then you go into the then branch of the if statement. So this is very similar. So you say X begin, so this could actually be a C function, and if X begin returns -1, then you know the transaction has started, and otherwise, if it doesn't return minus one, the transaction is aborting currently. So you say X begin. If it's minus one, then you're inside the transaction, and you have to end your block here with X end. So let's assume that we have some sort of shared array of 100 elements, and we have an update function that sets the index to the value. So what we actually increment it. So we add value to index, to data at the offset index. And otherwise, the transaction failed. So the user must provide fallback code because if the transaction fails, we could just try to rerun it again, so we could write a loop here, but since we're never guaranteed that the hardware transaction will succeed, we need a software failback. So, for instance, we could run the hardware transaction 10 times, and after that we give up and we do some sort of software implementation. Okay. So let's just fill in this fallback path by just like doing the update. So if the transaction fails, we just do the update. What's wrong with that?
One question.
Yes.
Do I understand correctly that the limitations of such, well, hardware-based fallbacks, for example, if you do not commit the transaction, then you have to somehow abort the write request or whatever. And so the limitations on these write or written data in general are based on the size of the cache line, for example. So if a transaction fails, then the cache line will not be written back to memory, for example. Right? But
yes.
Because my thought was you can simply, for example, write a transaction or create a transaction over 1 gigabyte of data, and it wouldn't be possible, I guess. Right?
No, it's cache-based because the cache is kind of like, I mean, mirrors. Yeah.
So the limitations are the actual cache line size.
Yes. The cache size and many other factors that Intel doesn't tell us. So I'm not sure what the other factors are. But you can certainly, I mean, there's also associativity of your cache. So, like, if you always write addresses at multiples of 256, you're probably in bad shape. But you will never have a transaction that's larger than your level, and there, I don't know, one cache, something like that. So that's actually, somebody says that what it is. I think it's level one cache and not level two or three.
Yes.
So and the level one cache, I think, is, I don't know, 4K or something, or maybe a bit more. And so it's very small, so the transaction won't be large.
Yeah.
There have been people working here that, like, I've seen a dissertation on that where they've tried how big this can be and drew their conclusion whether it's useful for them or not. But it's very small, or rather small. Okay, so this is my version that of trying to provide a fallback path. There's like a text up here which kind of hints what might be wrong here. So what is wrong here? There's something wrong with this code. So what I want is to increment something atomically. I'm writing a transaction that does exactly that, and then I have a fallback path in case the transaction fails.
Well, the second part isn't executed atomically.
Yes. Yeah. So if I execute this piece of code with the same piece of code, then imagine both transactions are not run, but the fallback path is run. Then I'm running two non-atomic pieces of two non-atomic updates in parallel, and I might just get the wrong value. Okay, so if the fallback path code is executed, it might be interrupted by another interrupted in the sense that a transaction, even a transaction, might just intervene in this update. So that the write and the fallback path will override the value of the transaction. So the transaction succeeds, but the fallback path will then read something stale, like before the transaction, and write something after the transaction, thereby making, overriding what the transaction has computed. So I need to put this fallback path also in some sort of protection. so that it is executed atomically. So the way what we learned is like we use locks to do this. So we use locks to execute something atomically. So I need to add I use lock to prevent this interruption from happening. So I'm creating a mutex using a lock. So I say wait on the mutex. I do the update and then do signal on the mutex. So now if I run this code in parallel with itself, then the fallback path will not run in parallel with other fallback paths. However, now the subtlety is that the transaction region may not run in parallel with a fallback path either, because so here I'm not saying anything about the mutex value, but if some software if the lock is taken, then obviously my transaction should not run. So there's the same problem. Now I have a software, I have a lock, and I have a transaction, and the transaction is unaware of the lock. Since the transaction is simply ignoring the lock, the transaction can still run, read the value while the critical section here is executed, and so I still can get the wrong result. So what I need to do is I need to check whether the mutex is taken, and if the mutex is taken, I issue an X abort. Is this now correct? Or do I have to check at the end of this transaction whether mutex is still zero and abort if it isn't? Okay, so earlier we said that, okay, so how is hardware transaction memory implemented? I'm using my cache, and all my read set is kind of in my cache. It's just a cache line that has this tag, oh, this is transactional. So I might read mutex into a cache line, and it's marked as transactional. If somebody else tries to write the mutex, then I will get a read request that goes to my cache line, and then that will abort my transaction. So by reading mutex once, it is in my read set, and if somebody tries to write to it, which the wait will do, my transaction will abort. And it will abort no matter when this write happens. So as soon as some other code path executes the lock, while I'm in my transaction, while I'm down here in this part of the transaction up to the X end, my transaction will abort. So this code is now correct. Okay.
But then we would have an aborted transaction, and we would need to
restart. Yes, but we have the fallback path, which will then also take the same lock, which, since it's taken, will probably fail initially, but eventually we will succeed. Yeah, it's not so pretty. So So the scalability is very, very good, and then suddenly it's like an overloaded network. Suddenly everybody is trying to use the lock because transaction doesn't run through. As soon as one thread takes the lock, then all the transactions will fail. That's a bit of a problem. Okay, so how is it implemented? So while we augment every cache line with this extra bit T, which stands for transactional, and we have a nesting counter somewhere in the processor that nests how many transactions we've nested so far, and it's zero if we're outside of any transaction. So I'm having this counter here in outside of the CPU, and we have this spare register bank, so if I start a transaction, I copy the whole CPU state that can be updated by a transaction in here into this separate register bank, and I have the counter, so I increment the counter. So what happens is if I then issue an X begin, I increment C. And if C was zero, that means if I was outside the transactional region, then I'm now entering the transactional mode, and I'm going to do a backup of all registers. Then on every read or write access to a cache line from within the processor, I will mark the corresponding T bit of the cache line as 1, so I will set it. And I can do this basically based on the fact whether the counter is greater than zero. So if the counter is zero, I'm not going to set the T bit. If the counter is greater than zero, I'm going to set the T bit. So this is then that I do just for all the read and write access that instructions generate. So this is rather orthogonal to the semantics of the instructions. But I have to like modify the MESI protocol a little bit. So if I have to apply an invalidate message from the invalidate queue to the cache, and it affects the cache line where the T bit is set, that means I'm overwriting a cache line, or somebody asks me that they overwriting a cache line that is part of my transaction, I do the same action as what an exabort would do. I'm stopping the transaction, and I roll back what I had and in my register bank. I set the counter to zero, and I jump to the fallback path from the outermost transaction. So if I see a read message on the bus, and that read is to a modified cache line with T, that means somebody's trying to read a cache line that is in my write set that I've already written to, and as part of the transaction, I also need to issue an exabort or do the semantics, whatever the exabort would do. And what does exabort do? Well, it clears all the T flags of all the cache lines because it jumps out of the outermost transaction. And there it sets the counter to zero, it restores the CPU registers, and it jumps to the fallback path of the outermost xbegin. And if my software issues an X commit, I will decrement C, and only if I'm at the if this X commit matches the outermost X begin, then I'm actually finishing all the transactions, so my counter drops to zero. Then I simply clear all the T flags, and I'm done. My transaction has run through, and I've successfully committed it. So obviously, this is much faster. The commit is much easier than with this TF2 where you have to lock objects and write back data and then unlock the objects again. It doesn't have deadlocks. It simply works because it's in hardware. It just like is very, it's like a normal instructions. Its effect is rather instantaneous. So no bus traffic or anything. So how can we illustrate this with our happened before diagrams? So let's augment the MESI states by adding an extra T tag for each cache line. So that means we're duplicating the states. So now we have modified and modified transactionally and exclusive transactionally and invalid. We don't have to duplicate. Okay, so we have A. We have the two operations that I've shown you earlier. So you have split them into two. So first we're reading the value, then into a temporary register. Then, so this is not in memory, this is in register. Then we update the value in memory with a sum. And then we do an X end. So both transactions have an X begin in front of them, and I'm not interested in that. I just know that there are. So initially the cache line in A of the data is exclusive 5, say, and in B it's invalid. So here it's invalid. Now what happens, so the first CPU executes the read of the data, and then my cache line is in transactional exclusive 5 state because I've seen an X begin and I'm doing a read access. Now the second thread tries to read from the data array. Since it's not in the cache, it's invalid, it sends a read request. And the read request here will not, because it's not an invalidate, it's okay if somebody else reads this value. So basically, the cache line will read. Normally, what state would the cache line be in if it was exclusive beforehand? What is it now?
Shared.
So it is transactionally shared with value 5. So it comes back down here. It is shared 5 as well. But because this is also inside a transaction, I'm going to set the T bit down here. So the fact that the T bit is set down here has nothing to do that the processor here up there is up here is in transactional mode. It's just because this processor down, the processor B, is in transactional mode. Okay, what happens then? I'm writing this updated value to the store buffer, but it's not applied yet. So this just lingers in the store buffer until later. And then the second CPU tries to compute this value and updates the data array at that index point. And now we'll go to the store buffer. And from the store buffer, it goes directly to the cache line that's in shared 5, and now it will be in which state will it be in? I'm realizing this is probably not very correct. Oh, well, we'll just do this. I'm not going to ask you what it is. So basically, I'm writing this. Oh, no, I'm reading. This is correct. I'm not writing. Yes, sorry. So I'm writing. What am I doing? My cache line is in shared state. I'm writing. What am I doing? Sending an invalidate message. What will this invalidate message normally do up here? Oh, it's in shared. So, yeah, sorry, I'm getting confused. So it's in shared state. In which state will my cache line be if my aim is to write it?
Modified.
It will be eventually modified once I write it. So up here it will be modified. I don't care about the value. Let's say 6. Will still be in transactional. Okay, but I have sent this invalidate message and I have received an acknowledge. So it will be modified 6. It's still transactional. And then eventually I'll see this X end here and that will just simply clear the T flag and everything is good. So the second transaction has run through. Now in the first transaction I have this invalidate message and this invalidate message will basically make the transaction fail. This right here needs to be, so I have a fail, and this write that is still lingering in the store buffer, once it arrives, it needs to be ignored as well. So I need to remove all the modified cache lines that are in transactional state from the cache and set them to invalid. So here I only have a shared cache line, which is okay, I can keep that shared, but everything that's modified, I need to clean out of the cache, I need to go through my store buffer. And for instance, here I have this store still in my store buffer. I need to remove that. And then I fail. So failing also clears all the memory states. And so this cache line will be back in S5 where it was before. So and everything that's modified it will be set to invalid so that I don't know anything about these addresses. Okay. Are there any questions to this? Well, S is shared.
Exactly, but it's not shared anymore.
Oh, yeah, but that's because of invalidate. So, this is invalid because the other CPU told me to invalidate it. Yes, you're right. And so this will still be invalid. But not because of the failing transaction. It will be invalid because of the invalidate request. Thank you. Okay. So that's the transaction. So now let's think about this pattern once more that we had for the fallback path. So what we've done here on the left is the same code as before. So we checked whether the mutex was taken. If the mutex was taken, we need to abort the transaction. Otherwise, the other locked version could run in parallel with the transaction. And the transaction we update, the critical section is the same, even though I have a typo in here. So there. So we have the critical section. It's either protected by a lock in the fallback path or in the transactional part. We check that the fallback path isn't running by checking that mutex is greater or equal to 0. And otherwise, it's the same thing. So this is kind of like a pattern that seems to be what you would normally write if you implement your fallback path by a lock. So let's try to factor this out. Which then reduces to the idea that this critical section may simply be executed without taking the lock. And this is called lock elision. So let's factor this out. So this update function basically locks a mutex and then unlocks a mutex, like the fallback path. But I'm now calling it lock and unlock because lock and unlock are implemented as follows. The lock will simply start a transaction and then check if in parallel we have the locked version running, we do an abort. Otherwise, it's all okay and we return. Otherwise, we acquire the lock. So basically, I've taken this piece of code and this piece of code and I've turned it into acquiring a lock. And then I have an unlock function after the critical section that's down here. And here I'm saying if the mutex is greater than zero, meaning I have acquired the lock and I'm the only one who has acquired the lock because nobody else can acquire the lock while I have the lock, I hope. Yeah, I think so. I'm doing a signal on the mutex, and otherwise I end the transaction. So what I've done here is I try to find a condition that tells me whether I'm in a transaction or not, and then I took the statements that terminate both kinds of ending the transaction and putting them here into this function. So I basically took out the mutex up here, and I did the locking up here and the unlocking down here, and it's kind of like factored in a different way to have a lock, unlock, and the critical section. Yes?
The cool thing about it is that you don't need the operating system anymore to lock a mutex, right?
You never need the operating system to lock a mutex unless you want to suspend. So, I mean, the locks don't have to go into the operating system. They could just spin lock, spin weight. Well, if you hardware transaction aborts 100 times in a row, you might want to ask the operating system to suspend yourself. So it's orthogonal. Okay, so this common pattern I can refactor as I've shown. And what I'm doing here is basically it's like I'm trying to execute a critical section, and if it doesn't create any conflicts, fine. If it creates conflicts, I'm acquiring the lock, and then I have the lock to ensure that I can succeed. So, and as we've discussed earlier, as soon as one thread in this setup here conflicts with something else, with some other thread, it will abort and will take the lock in the fallback path, and that will have this avalanche effect that it will abort thereby all other transactions that have read mutex. So if there's many transactions, they all have read mutex, and they all assume nobody is actually locking, then this thread that does the locking will abort all of them. But what happens if all these transactions run in parallel and they happily do their transaction without failing? Then they all see the lock from like the outside lock from the other process as being not taken because mutex is still zero. So that's why it's called lock elision. So elide means it's kind of like gone away. And so there is you executing the critical section without actually taking the lock, hence the name lock elision. And so this piece of code here is basically implemented in hardware, and that's the second part that Intel provides, this lock elision. So hardware lock elision is basically exactly the same as I've shown you on the last slide, but it's implemented in hardware. And it's very close to this RT, the other one that I've discussed earlier, the restricted transactional memory, the RTM. So using this hardware transactional memory to implement this lock elision is a common pattern. And so Intel provides a special handling in hardware, also because it's much easier to transform current software that is already written. So basically, it provides a special way to execute a critical section without the overhead of the atomic updates required to release and acquire the lock. So basically, instead of atomic updates that are used to implement signal and wait, wait and signal, you can just use the hardware transactional memory facilities to try not to do it and just abort if you didn't succeed with a transaction. So, and all it does is it basically you take these atomic instructions that implement the locking and you prefix them. So the instruction that sets the semaphore to zero, so the instruction that does the wait in a successful way so that the semaphore is taken, is prefixed with an X-acquire instruction, and that's not really an instruction, it's just a prefix. And then the instruction that increments the semaphore, so that the one that releases it, that sets the mutex back to 1, is prefixed with an X-release. And so Intel has this, all sorts of weirdo prefixes, and these prefixes are already existing, but they're usually never used in front of these instructions. So I think they correspond to repeat prefixes, which are used for string operations or for copying operations. And so if you use a repeat prefix before a compare and swap operation, you will suddenly get an elided acquisition of a lock. And since these prefixes are ignored on older platforms because they don't make any sense, it's backwards compatible, so you can run newer code on the old hardware. So for successful lock elision, obviously you have to annotate all signal and wait operations that wait on the same lock. Otherwise, one will take the lock and the other transactions will abort. Okay, and as I explained earlier, this elision, by simply reading the mutex, checking that it's not 1, then mutex will be in your read set, and globally the mutex variable will always be 0, so as if the lock is not taken. So globally, the mutex variable is visible as 0. Oops, as 1. As not taken, so it should be 1, sorry. sorry, this is locally. Yep. Mea culpa. Is this the right button? Yes. So locally, from the point of view of the CPU, and this is special, this is different to the restricted transaction memory where we simply ignore the mutex variable. Locally, because the processor pretends that you have set the lock to 1, locally, you will, if you read the lock, it will read 1, which is a bit of magic, because in the cache and everywhere else, it reads 0. So other processors, if they try to check whether somebody's actually in the critical section, they will, using the cache protocol, they will read 1. And then because of this pretense that there's something special going on, two views of the memory with respect to the lock variables, only a finite number of locks can be elided. Also because there's only a finite number of transactions that can be managed at the same time. There's only ever 1, sorry. Yeah, so there's a hardware limit here. So, and the nice thing, if I read the documentation correctly, the nice thing about this lock elision, and that which is a real advantage over the restricted transactional memory, is that only one, so if there's a conflict, only one elided lock. Now, there's always one elided lock that can proceed because one will win, so to say. So there's a progress guarantee since if some processor tries to read the lock or has a conflict, then the lock is actually acquired. So this is so there's one transaction where which is then irrevocably executed. So as soon as there is a conflict on this locking variable and somebody else, as soon as the transaction that executes the lock elided transaction, as soon as there is a conflict, we cannot abort the transaction because there's no fallback path. So basically at that point in time, the lock, the mutex variable that is globally seemingly visible as not taken is now written, and it looks like it's as if it is taken. And so that makes this transaction irrevocably executed, so it will not fail anymore. And all the other transactions that have started will fail and they will redo what they've done. And because of that, there's no backup path required, because as soon as the lock is visibly taken by one processor and visible to others as taken, then all the other processors will actually also acquire the lock and never try to execute the the lock instruction transactionally anymore. So, of course, that means that you have an avalanche of block threads of, yeah, so they all will block on the lock if one of the elision elided locks fails, because it will then definitely acquire the lock, but then it's the same behavior as before. And it's easy to convert existing programs. Okay, so implementation of lock elision. So basically, it is mostly based on the infrastructure for restricted transactional memory. But because we have this weird local view is different of the mutex variable is different from the global view of the mutex variable, we need an additional buffer for the elided locks, similar to the store buffer. So we still have this register backup bank that we need in order to abort the transaction and redo the elided lock atomic block with the lock taken. We have the counter for the nesting, just because it's, well, we don't need the counter. And what we have in addition is this special buffer of elided locks. So there we keep all the addresses of the mutex variables that we've taken with this X acquire prefix, because if our critical section reads the value of the mutex variable, it has to read as 1, whereas in the cache and globally, this variable reads as 0. So this is kind of like a, remember when we have a read and there's still a store in the store buffer that writes that address, then we obviously need to look at the value that we're going to write at that address, so to get the consistent view that if we read something and we read it, if we write something then we read it, that we read what we've written. So we have to consult the store buffer anyway each time we read. So we consult the store buffer and the buffer of elided locks. And that tells us that we should read something else than what's really in the memory. So what does it do? So if we have a lock, if we take the semaphore and it's prefixed with an X acquire, then we create a shared or exclusive cache line with one that is set to 1. We issue an xbegin and we store the elided lock in this elided lock buffer. So we need so we'll have the mutex cache line in here, and it will read 0. I think I've just written this down just so we know that the process is in transactional state. So we have at least one cache line that's 1. Of lock ensures. Oh, yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah, what this says is basically we need the mutex variable to be in our cache so that if somebody else tries to write the mutex variable, we can abort if necessary. So we'll get an invalidate message, and then we will tell the other not, we will not acknowledge the invalidate if we are the one to succeed in executing our transaction. Okay, so the read-write access is set T as before. If we apply an invalidate message to a cache line with T equals 1, an X abort happens. Oh, yeah, so if we read the address of the mutex variable, of the elided lock, and we will access the elided lock buffer and read a 0 as if it's taken, but the cache contains 1. So if somebody else will read the mutex variable, they will read 1. If we do an X release on the same lock, we will decrement the C counter, and if it's 0, we will clear the T flags just as before, and we'll also clear the elided lock buffer. So that means once we clear the elided lock buffer, then suddenly, magically, we see the global view of the mutex variable, which is 1, because that's saying the lock is not taken. Okay, in summary, so as you see, I'm finishing early today. So transaction memory aims to provide a convenient translation for atomic blocks, for general code. So It frees the user from deciding how to use locked data structures, how many locks you need. And it's also compositional because two nested transactions behave like one transaction and can be used using software or using hardware or usually a combination, maybe a combination thereof. So the devil definitely lies in the details. It's not as easy as with SQL databases. So the semantics of the explicit HTM, so where you create large atomic operations from primitive instructions and software transactional memory anyway, all these the semantics is very subtle when you mix it with non-transactional memory and even with when you allow when you have zombie transactions that could observe an inconsistent state, which is the weak where the strong that's the non-transactional part. And it's a question whether you have opacity or not. Okay, we have for non-transactional accesses, we've discussed the single log automaticity and the transaction sequential consistency. And you could also use these concepts probably to talk about what zombie transactions see, but I'm really only interested here in defining and using these concepts to talk about non-transactional accesses. And in general, the gist is I don't want software transaction memory to be used as some sort of synchronization primitive so that I can, for instance, set a lock variable or something like that. I'll say this is now private to me or this is public, because then all these semantics subtleties when you access something non-transactionally and when not come into play. So usually it's better to avoid that. So the opacity is a good thing because then zombie transactions cannot observe an inconsistent state. If I want to provide opacity, I cannot directly write to memory, but I have to do a redo lock, or I have to do eager conflict detection. So if a conflict occurs, I'm detecting it immediately, so I don't start doing something that. I never have zombie transactions. And lazy version management is the redo lock. So devils in implicit, so like the Intel style hardware transactional memory, the first version we've seen, the restricted transactional memory requires a fallback path, and there we have all these subtle interacts between the transaction and hardware, and then somehow the implementation of the atomic block in software. RTM has no progress guarantee, and then Intel provides hardware lock elision. As far as I understand, it has a progress guarantee, but it's not very clear. And in general, this hardware lock elision can be used with this pattern that I've shown in by using the RTM primitives. And in fact, the pthreads library, they have extended it to use software transactional memory, hardware transactional memory of Intel's processors, and they use RTM, they don't use HLE. So that they do that because they, once a transaction fails, they want to retry to do the transaction once or twice, and then they have a backup counter, very complicated strategies to make locks behave reasonably well in many circumstances, and there they want to control everything. So they put it all into a normal transaction and then do the backup themselves. Okay. Availability, well, software transaction memory usually comes in libraries because nobody can really be bothered to create whole languages. And then you have to do a lot of fiddling with your own code because you have to usually change read and write accesses. There's a GCC implementation or extension that has some sort of keyboard transactional atomic, and it turns it automatically then the code inside this block into library calls. And there is libITM that provides many of the software transactional memory algorithms, and there's some sort of proposal that's being implemented in C++ and all of that. So hardware lock elision is quite limited, so it allows you to easily convert existing locks because you can use these prefixes that are ignored on older architectures, and you don't want any atomic increment of a counter to be a lock. So you have to manually say, this is a lock that worked, it is safe and makes sense to elision, because you could acquire a lock to write to a file, and obviously you don't want that. You don't want to elide that lock, because that's not going to get you very far and break your program. As I said, the PFAS library uses RTM. There's an article on the net if you want to read it, because they have some sort of special backoff mechanism that they always had, and they still want to have it even in the presence of HLE. In the presence of hardware transaction memory. So this HLE is only a very special case of a general lock. So if you want to have monitor semantics like condition variables and re-entrance, then you have to do extra stuff. So it's not so easy. And if you use HLE, the hardware transaction memory, then there's certain things that were allowed, like the monitor thing, re-entrance, and many other things that are not allowed anymore. And also there's some certain error conditions that they cannot detect anymore. So be careful. An outlook. So these were six lectures, and there's much more on concurrency. I'll just give you a brief overview. So there's many other things, like principles, not many, but like one is very important that I haven't talked about, another principle from concurrent program, which is message passing. So there is non-blocking message passing, which is often referred to as the actor model. So the idea is that a program is a collection of actors that are kind of all active by themselves, and they all send messages to each other. And in software engineering, you have some, for instance, you model Java, different objects that as with message sequence charts where you send messages, but that's really rather awkward because every time you send a message, then the other object has to respond because you have to do a method call and you have to wait for the return. But with the actor model, you can really send a message and the other, and you run on and the other object runs on. So each actor has a queue of incoming messages, and the messages can be processed, and new messages can be sent independently. You can even do filters of incoming messages, and probably the best implementation of this is Erlang, which is a language once developed by Ericsson, and is now, they're not very... They used to do many mobile phones. Then they did the hardware that does the cellular network itself, and that's where Erlang had its stronghold, because Erlang can do hot swap code replacement, and you can distribute your system over a large set of nodes. And if one node fails, it doesn't matter because then some connections are lost, but the system as a whole works on. So Erlang is still a very interesting design. And this actor model has been added to many, many existing languages where it's not quite as neat as in Erlang. Then there's blocking message passing. So you send a message and you cannot continue until the other process has read the message. This is like there's theoretical concepts like communicating sequential processes, which is a calculus for describing concurrency, similar to the lambda calculus for describing computation, so it's a generalization. There's a pi calculus, and there's also a join calculus. So what's common is that these processes all send a message over a channel, and then they block until the other recipient accepts it, and then the CSP is not so strong. The pi is more, pi calculus is more general, so in the pi calculus you can actually send channels and not only messages, so it's kind of higher order. And examples are Occam, Occam Pi. So Occam used to be, has been developed to run, to program transputers, which is a term that probably doesn't ring a bell with you guys anymore. So it's basically the idea is you have a hypercube of processors, and each processor has, well, if it's a two-dimensional grid, then each processor has four channels, one to each neighbor. And then you have to program in a way that just talks to your direct neighbor, which is very awkward. Occam Pi tries to do that in a more general way. More modern implementation is Google's Go language. They have blocking message channels. And there's completely different ways of doing concurrency. So if you're in the embedded world, you usually have a controller doing stuff, and then there's an interrupt, the controller does something very urgently, and then it's done and the main thread continues. And if you then add timers into the mix and different levels of priority so that one interrupt may interrupt the other one but not vice versa, then you can assign priorities to different resources and say, well, only the process with the highest priority will write and will never be interrupted by a process with a lower priority. So you have processes, for instance, interrupts with a priority, and resources that each process may acquire. And each resource has the maximum priority of all processes that may acquire it. And the process priority at runtime may increase, and namely, it may increase to the maximum of the priorities of the held resources. So if you pick up a resource that has a higher priority than yourself, then suddenly your priority is up here, and the other interrupt that has the same priority and usually used to have a higher one than you cannot interrupt you anymore. And that way you have exclusive access to this resource that normally would be modified by the higher priority interrupt. So there we go. Okay, this is it. This is the literature. Some blog entries on Haswell, and you can obviously find the press article from this spring that HTM in interprocesses is broken. Okay. Are there questions? Okay, so next week there will be Michael talking about something completely different. If there are questions towards the exam, then we could have some sort of like, well, you can always send me emails. We could try to organize a question and answer session because we have a lot of time left after the lecture. There will be a visiting lecture, I think, in January, but we'll have at least one slot where we could do a question and answer session. Okay. So thank you very much.